Exercise number 31392, Reel 2.
Burridge, Reel 2. How did your training start? What was the initial training that you did?
Well, when you join the Navy, it doesn't matter which branch, they try to make you into a sailor first and foremost. And so the first 2 months, we had no connection whatsoever with aviation. We were sent to what used to be the boys' training establishment at HMS St Vincent in Gosport. There, we learnt seamanship, flag signals, naval discipline, marching, everything except anything to do with aviation.
Can we go through some of those? Because obviously you said drill, so you'd had some experience already in the Home Guard.
That's right.
Did it differ in any way when you were doing drill? Did you have to form up differently, or was the...
No. No, military drill is very similar in all the services.
And were you with the drill, were you given an opportunity to take... the group, take command of the group?
Certainly, because that was part of our training, because we were going to be officers. Because show that we were like officer cadets, instead of having an HMS band around our sailor hats, we had a white band, which signified officer cadets.
Was there a lot of emphasis put on drill at that stage?
Oh yes, very much so. And we had to take it in turns to take charge of the squad.
Did everybody adjust to that?
No, not at all. Some of them were absolutely hopeless. And they were weeded out quite quickly.
What happened to the ones who were weeded out?
Well, the term was they were dipped. In other words, they... One day they just didn't turn up.
You did seamanship. What did that entail? What were the types of things you did?
Sort of Boy Scouty sort of things. Learning your knots, how to man a boat. We had to do that. We had to sail a whaler around Gosport Harbour.
With the knots, how did you learn to do knots?
Well, most of us have been in the Scout, so it wasn't anything very new to us.
Were you given a rope to practice with or something?
Oh, yes, certainly. We had to be proficient in certain types of knots, and then we had to learn all the parts of a ship, what to do to drop the anchor, and the names of... various bits and pieces on a ship. Oh, they did try to teach us to be sailors.
You said you did signals training. What did that entail?
At that stage, only flag signals, which were used very, very much in the Navy and still are, because they're the only ones that cannot be intercepted. And if you're within sight of another ship, it's by far the safest way to signal. Matter of fact, we had to know them even in the Fleet Air Arm, because radio silence was generally observed at sea in wartime. And so you could fly alongside a ship and read the flag signals.
With the flag signals... How does that work? Is it individual letters or are they part messages?
Yes, there's a flag for each letter. And so, of course, it's abbreviated. They don't necessarily make every letter in a word. They just put sufficient so that you can understand the gist. And letter for... A flag for a certain letter can signify a whole sentence or a whole word. Like, if you flew alongside a ship and you saw D20, that meant delay landing 20 minutes.
So how did you go about learning all these flag signals initially?
Well, just like you learn things at school.
So was it classroom work then?
Oh yes, definitely classroom work.
Did you have any practical experience with flags?
Not really, no. It was all classroom work.
So at that stage you would just sit down and you would learn almost by rote what each flag meant? And
yes, we spent most of the day in classrooms and part of the day, a small part of the day outside doing practical work, such as learning your knots and doing seamanship training and things like that.
Who were your instructors?
Rather elderly chief petty officers who most of them had been taken out of retirement, but of course they were very, very knowledgeable and very nice people too, because they'd already retired and they'd mellowed.
And were they very experienced in naval matters?
Oh yes, very, very much so, because most of them had spent a lifetime in the Navy. There was one famous one who everybody still talks about, who's been to HMS St Vincent, Chief Petty Officer Wilmot.
What was he like?
Well, he appeared to be extremely stern. He had his eyes everywhere. If you moved in the back row, he seemed to even remember your name. And he was a most marvellous character, but people met him afterwards, and he was the nicest chap you could imagine.
Did you do any weapons training at this stage?
We were sent to Whale Island, the gunnery school, to learn how to man a 4-inch gun. Enough said.
How long did this kind of basic training take in seamanship?
2 months. And then after the 2 months, we had a short weekend leave, and then we were sent to RNAS, Royal Naval Air Station, Eastleigh, which is now Southampton Airport, to do 2 months of signal training. That is radio procedure, Morse, and again flag signals, semaphore, all aspects of signals.
With the radio procedure, what does that entail? What kind of...
Receiving and sending Morse, generally in 4-letter codes, and you work up to the highest speed possible. We had to pass out at 22 words a minute, which is about as fast as you can write, and it takes you a long time, and you've got to concentrate on it. And after that, the normal sending speed of about 14-15 seems to be absolutely leisurely.
How did they instruct you in that? How do you learn to do at that speed?
It was a petty officer instructor who was experienced in it. And you just start off, of course, first of all you learn the Morse code, and then you do it slowly, you send it slowly and receive it slowly. And you gradually build up speed. It takes a time because it's a very, very concentrated procedure. And you've got to be pretty fit. You can't afford to have a hangover from the night before.
And are you given a set then, and somebody's sending... Is the instructor sending Morse to all of the...
Yes, yes. You've each got headphones and a writing pad, and he sends... A signal in Morse at a certain speed, and you've got to take it all down, and then you're assessed on how many mistakes you've made, and eventually you're writing as fast as you possibly can, and your mind is by then attuned to it. And of course, as soon as you've passed out at 22 words a minute, I doubt if you could ever do it at 22 words a minute again. But, of course, you'd never get it sent to you at 22 words a minute.
And I take it at that stage there would have been some people who just wouldn't be able to get the hang of it.
Oh, yes. Throughout the course, at various stages, you've always got these chaps who dip the course, as they say, and fall out. They just sort of don't appear one day. They've been told quietly that... they have to be doing something else.
Were most of the people on the course very keen?
Oh, absolutely, because we were all volunteers. We all wanted to do it, and we all wanted to fly. We were getting rather impatient by this time, because we'd hardly ever seen an aeroplane even.
So what happened after Eastleigh? Where did you get sent to next?
At Eastleigh, then that was the final instruction before the actual flying would start. Then came the problem, because they used to do the observer flying training at Ford in Sussex, and which was rather a dangerous spot for enemy aircraft, and so they split up the observers training school between Arbroath in Scotland and Trinidad in the West Indies, and I was selected for the Trinidad branch, which meant that we would have to take a ship to the West Indies.
Can you tell me about that, what the voyage was like?
Yes. We had about 10 days leave, as far as I can remember, and then we were told to report to Scotland, to the Clyde, where we boarded a 5,000-ton Dutch merchant ship, the Maaskirk. By that time, I think there must have been about 40 of us. There were quite a number of cabins on the upper deck. It used to take about 12 or 24 passengers. I think it was about 12 cabins. And so they crowded us into the cabins. We were reasonably comfortable. And the Dutch crew were very, very friendly, of course. And then we joined a slow convoy across the Atlantic. It took 2 weeks to get to Boston. And that's when we learnt whether we had our sea legs or not. I was sick for the first 2 days, but after that I enjoyed it.
Was there any threat from U-boats at all to the convoy?
We were a lucky convoy. As I said earlier in this interview, they didn't seem to be aiming at me throughout the war, so except once, we'll come to that later. So we had a very, very quiet passage. And then when we got to the other side, the U-boats were concentrating on the American seaboard by that time, and the Americans hadn't started convoy protection. And so they were losing lots and lots of ships within sight of their coast. And so, as we were a fairly small ship, they routed us inland through canals, which was quite interesting. We went through the Cape Cod Canal, and then the Chesapeake-Delaware Canal, and we didn't see the sea again until we got way down south near Norfolk, Virginia, which was very, very interesting. But we could see all this marvellous new country that we'd all heard about and never seen, and we never got off the ship once. Well, they didn't dare let us off, I should imagine.
What happened when you got to Norfolk, Virginia? Where did it go from there? Did it go
we did a solo dash across the Caribbean and got to Trinidad without any problems. Again, we were very, very lucky, and we weren't harassed at all.
What happened when you arrived in Trinidad?
In Trinidad? We were just taken ashore into this strange, exotic, tropical place, because most of us had never been out of England, and taken straight to Piarco, which was about 15 miles inland, which was the one and only airport. And half of it was civilian and half of it was military. And it was a Fleet Air Arm training base.
What was your accommodation like there?
This was open. When I say open huts, it had, instead of windows, it had gauze wire to stop the insects, which allowed air through, because the temperature was a fairly constant 80 to 90 degrees and quite humid, and so That was something we had to get used to at the time, the heat. Because of the heat, we had a different working day. We used to rise at 4:30 in the morning and had one training session just with a cup of tea until breakfast about 8 o'clock. A quick breakfast and then another training session up till noon, after which it became too hot to do anything, let alone fly. And then we were free to sleep in the afternoon, which we needed to, having got up so early.
What did the training involve at this stage? Did you start your navigation training?
That's right. We started flying immediately. We had three types of aircraft there. The Percival Proctor, which was a light plane, which was designed for private flyers, a three-seater, and that was used for navigation and radio training. The pilot sat in the front right-hand seat, the radio operator was in the left-hand seat, and there was a small aft-facing navigation table at the rear. So in any one flight, one of the observers learnt the radio procedure and one learnt navigation. And the other aircraft we had were Fairey Albacores, which were seconded from a operational squadron, and so they were fully equipped with radio and radar. We had radar in those days, which was 1942, on our training aircraft, which was quite remarkable. People are surprised when they hear that. And so we were able to go straight into radar training. It wasn't called radar then, because that was a later American term. It was called ASV, air-to-surface vessels.
Can you tell me about that, what that training entailed?
The radar training, you mean? Oh, yes. Used to just go out on a... If it wasn't a navigation trip, we used to go out on a radar operation, and you just headed out to sea, because it's only worked over sea, this type of radar. It was useless over land because you just got continuous land echoes, and so you couldn't pick out anything. You could only pick out a coastline. In other words, the sea gave you no returns and land gave you returns. And so you head out to sea and then return back towards land, and then find out, or of course there'd be ships as well, and you'd locate anything that appeared, that gave an echo and directed the pilot in that direction, because what you got was a television screen, small television screen, with a green fluorescent line running down the middle. Black lines across giving you the range in miles. It went up to 70 miles, this. It had three, switches. One was complete 70 miles, and then if you got closer, you had to put it down to, I think it was 30 miles, so you could get closer there before you lost it in the what they call the ground returns. And then when you got really close, you had, I think it was, I can't remember now, maybe 10 miles. And then you could get down to within a mile of your target, by which time you could probably see it.
And what did the echoes look like?
Well, if there was nothing in front of you, you just got this horizontal, this vertical green line. If there was anything of any substantial size, or if it was small and metal, it gave you a good echo, like a floating oil drum would give you a decent echo at 10 miles. It would be a horizontal blip. Instead of being a vertical line, you'd get a horizontal bit come out, and you could read the range on that. Now, you had to con the pilot so that the echo was equidistant on both sides of the horizontal of the vertical line, by which time you could say it was dead ahead so many miles.
Navigation training, what did that entail?
We had no navigational aids whatsoever, and our radios were pretty useless. We didn't have any voice on our primitive sets. All we had was Morse, and as I say, and no direction finding at all. And so all our navigation was done by what they call dead reckoning, which was using a compass, an estimated wind, and your airspeed. And with that you made a triangle of forces and work out which way you had to steer to keep a certain track. You know, your track is what your actual line over the map. Your course is where you're pointed. And of course the wind will make a difference between your course and your track, unless you've got a wind directly ahead of you or directly behind you.
Was there any way of taking measurements of the wind?
Yes.
Flight?
We had various methods of finding the wind, which involved dropping a smoke float and then the pilot doing a regulated complete turn round. And after 3 minutes, if there was no wind, you'd be directly over your smoke float. After 3 minutes, the bearing of the smoke float from you is the direction of the wind, because that's where it's blown you. And then we had a formula, mathematical formula, which involved a stopwatch and taking times when your smoke float was abeam and when it was on the quarter, and you worked it out with this formula, and that gave you the wind speed.
So would that allow you then to get back on track if you were?
Yeah, that gave you, well, you'd finish up on the original track and you'd have lost 3 minutes, so you take 3 minutes off your log, but then you would know your accurate wind. The important thing was finding a wind like that. That was the wind at your height, not at sea level. You could say that you could look at down there and you could see the ripples, you say the wind's that way, but it can be very different as you get higher. So it's important to know your wind at your height.
Did the weather affect navigation out in the Caribbean?
It wasn't really a good place to learn navigation, because the weather was fairly constant. And when we found a wind, if it wasn't 090 15 knots, you know you'd made a mistake, because it was always 090 15 knots. Except very occasionally, and then you'd be in trouble.
So in your daily training routine, it would be a mixture then, would it, of radar training, navigation training, and also radio.
That's right, communications. Because we had to learn how to communicate with the ground.
Could you tell me about that?
Yes, because we didn't have voice on our radio, and we had to communicate by Morse. It was obviously too cumbersome to send whole sentences to make a request or get an answer. So we had what they called X signals. They had various numbers, X and 3 digits. And each of those, if you read your code book, meant something, such as X 254 might mean I want permission to land, or I want permission to take off, or any sort of message.
Given the weather conditions as well, what kind of flying kit were you wearing?
Well, of course, it was very, very hot there, and there were no health and safety rules in those days, we used to fly just in shorts, a May West life jacket, and sandals, and that was all. In these days, it wouldn't be allowed because it'd be a fire hazard, but nobody knew about that then.
Was there any other elements of the training that occurred?
Any
other elements of training that occurred while you were there? Yes.
Oh, yes. The other important thing was one of the important functions, particularly if you were on a battleship or cruiser-borne aircraft, when they used to catapult you off, you know, for various things, was to report fall of shot if there was firing, if a warship was firing. Then it was an important function of a fleet air arm aeroplane to report fall of shot. And I've got some interesting photographs there. We used to have some local West Indians used to pull models of ships along. And then there was another one who had little emblems which indicated a shell splash, and they would put the shell splashes near the ship, and you would have a rangefinder, and it was all to scale, you know. And when the chap put this simulated fall of shot there, then you had to send a Morse signal. We had a little Morse sender telling the ship what correction to make for his next salvo.
So was this done indoors then?
No, outdoors. Outdoors on the parade ground, because he needed quite a bit of space, because this West Indian would be pulling this model along, and there'd be another one putting the fall of shot in certain places.
What type of equipment did you have as an observer? What would you carry with you?
Well, we had a big square chartboard, which was about 2 feet square. On it was fastened the sliding rule, or parallel rule, which you needed to plot your courses. Had a course and speed calculator, which was like a mechanical computer in which you fed your airspeed and course and track. If you put your track on and you set your wind and your airspeed, and you turn the centre of it so that the pointer pointed to the track that you wanted to steer, and while you were doing that, another pointer would be automatically turning, and it would finish up telling you exactly what course to steer to go along that track. It was a primitive computer.
And how would you carry your stuff around? Would you have a bag or a
computer? Yes, we had a canvas bag to carry all this lot in.